From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the mid-1990s in Little River, New York. A 16-year-old girl named April was driving back to her home, it's a motorhome, after doing some grocery shopping. She was wearing her father's jacket and driving his truck. He didn't give her permission to take either of those things or to use his money to buy groceries. Their relationship is not a good one. When April's mother left them, they did their best to get by. Her father dated several women and ended up with a woman named Irene, a woman that April hates. Now her father lives and spends most of his time with Irene and her son. He forgot April's birthday, but he did give her his own guitar. That's something that she cherishes. He attends Irene's son's concerts, but not April's. In fact, April wanted to invite him to her first open mic performance where she played two original songs, but she didn't. She knew he wouldn't come. When she pulls back up to the motorhome, her father was outside, and she knew that he was furious. She could feel that he was about to explode. He was holding the neck of the guitar. He screamed at her again, and then there was an awful sound, a crack, loud and sharp, and it stayed in her ears after it was done. She knew that she would hear it in her mind for days. "There," he said, "I took something that's yours. How do you feel about that, April? How do you feel about that?" "Fine," she said, and she tossed him the keys. That was the last straw. After her father left, she packed up everything in that motorhome, including the diamond ring she found in her father's truck. She stole Irene's car and she left town. It was the first time that she would try to escape her life, but it wouldn't be the last. This is a scene from author Allison Larkin's new book, The People We Keep. It explores the power of personal connections, our struggle to live up to who we want to be, the pain of loss, and the way that sometimes we assume we will not be forgiven for the mistakes that we have made, and it's easier just to run from them. Allison Larkin is, well, we're going to claim her as a Rochester native here. She lives in California now, but her book here is gaining critical acclaim. It's called The People We Keep, and she's got a pile of novels now that are just wonderful. She's a good friend of mine, and I invited her on the program this hour because, you know, frankly, when you're getting the kind of press that Allison Larkin is getting, connections cannot ignore you anymore. I tried, Allie. I tried to ignore it. But how are you?
I'm good. How are you? That was such a beautiful summary of the beginning of the book. I appreciate it. I love how you talk about April like she's a real person, too, because that's how she feels to me.
Well, when you were writing about April, the first time you wrote about this person, this character, April, was years ago. And, you know, you've been, your first published novel was Stay, and what was the year?
That came out in 2010.
And, you know, your books are so good, but the publishing industry has this way of taking an author and saying, hey, this is what you are, and this is what we expect of you. And your first book had a dog on its cover, so you're the dog author now. And by the way, it's a great book. But did you find yourself wanting to explore this character of April, knowing that maybe the publishing industry would have preferred you to keep writing about dog-centric stuff?
It's really interesting. It's been such a long journey because I actually started writing about April in 2006. And I thought that her story would be my second book after my first novel, Stay. And so that actually was a big issue. This book is, you know, I feel like this book has kind of the same heart. I mean, because it comes from my heart as my other books, but it is different in tone. It doesn't have a dog in it. It doesn't fit as neatly in the box that my first three books fit in. So it was kind of this ongoing journey to find the right people to work with on this book. Because for a very long time, I think in publishing, when I went to someone with this book, their task to them became, how do we take this book and put it into the same box as the other three? And I wasn't really interested in doing that. So a lot of the advice I was getting was how to take this book about my traveling folk singer and And what if she stayed in one place and had friends her own age? Or what if she had a dog? And that just wasn't going to fit with the story. So my journey since 2006 has been trying to write the clearest story I could for April and then find the right people for it. I didn't always know that's what I was doing, but I just had this sense of this character who needed to exist a certain way, and it felt like my job to make that happen.
The book is called The People We Keep. I can hardly think of a better book for anyone who loves to sit down with a good novel, especially in a warm mug of coffee and a winter day. And we're going to be talking to more authors and talking about Rochester's favorite books. It's one of our favorite traditions at the end of the year that's coming up. So there's a lot of book theme to the month of December, and we're thrilled about that. This is a book that, you know, your readers might assume is maybe not autobiographical, but has elements of you. I actually think, Allie, that there are elements of you in April, in Carly, in Ethan. I mean, I find parts of you in the characters, if not any one character truly autobiographical. But to me, it's the most personal book that I have found in your collection so far. The book that is the most sort of your whole heart. And I love the fact that you thanked April as a character in your acknowledgments because she's so real to you. You even acknowledge, like, this may sound a little strange, but I'm going to thank this fictional character because she's very real to you, isn't she?
She is. I was working on Stay. I was working on my first novel for writing group and had pages due, and I was listening to a playlist, and Dar Williams was on the playlist, and then a song called This Is the Sea by the Water Boys. And for some reason, Dar Williams, who's a folk singer, got me thinking about what it was like to live on the road. And then the Water Boys song talks about, like, what parts of your life you keep as you move from a small place to a big place. And all of a sudden, April just showed up in my mind. I had this picture of this, you know, young woman with a guitar, and I actually wrote a lot of what ended up in the second half of the book in one night. I mean, it just ended up, I couldn't stop thinking about her. I couldn't write my pages for writing group. I had to write this other thing, and she has just existed like an old friend from college. You know, you can think about them, you can imagine what they might say. It's like you feel like you could pick up the phone and call them if you just could find their phone number. That's the way that April exists in my mind. And it's been a joy to spend, you know, almost 15 years imagining this. You know, it seems self-congratulatory to call her a very special person, but she has been an exceptional imaginary friend over the years. So I'm very thankful for that. I love that you picked out the parts of me from the other characters too, because I do think there's a lot of that. I think I did throw my whole self into this book, even though it's not my story. I feel like everything I ever experienced in my life gave me the palette that I needed to write it.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about some of the elements of this book. I mean, the book is very raw in many ways in dealing with poverty, in dealing with sort of fear of self-acceptance and sort of running from lies. And there's a lot that people relate to. And then there will be a lot that is tough to read about experiences that some of us have never had. By the way, speaking of the Water Boys, my favorite Water Boys song is the Glastonbury song. And there's a lyric in that song that says, "There is a green hill far away. I'm going back there one fine day." April thought about home and really never thought she could get back because of how badly damaged her life was back home. And there's a lot of Western New York. There's Buffalo area. There's Ithaca. She loves Ithaca. Do you love Ithaca as much as April loves Ithaca?
I love Ithaca so much. It's my favorite place in the whole world. I went to Ithaca College for 2 years, and at one point in the book, April says that she feels like Ithaca is the place that she started. And I actually, when I was in Rochester, I had to go down to Ithaca for something, and I was early for an appointment and ended up sitting in my car looking at the lake, and I had that feeling of, like, this is where I started. This is where everything in my life kind of took off, was when I went to college there. And I love to get to go back and visit when I can, and it's been too long now, but it's such a near and dear place to my heart.
talking to author Allison Larkin, whose new book is called The People We Keep. It's not giving too much away to give this plot detail. It's on the first page. She steals a car right away. And if you are a reader new, if you're kind of coming into this blind, not knowing much about this character, you might immediately be suspicious of someone's motive for stealing an old woman's car. But she's waiting for this woman to fall asleep in her mobile home. She knows she falls asleep at 8:30 at night. And she figures, I learned how to hotwire a car, or how to start with a screwdriver. I'm just going to take her car out to open mic, and I'm going to go play, and then I'll bring her car back. And, you know, I'm not going to do anything harmful because she doesn't have much. And she goes out to play open mic. And it's when you write about her music in particular, I love it because you capture the fear of performance that so many people have, whether it's music, singing, showing your art. I mean, just about everybody listening can think of something where they might have been nervous to show it off for the first time. And you capture that really, really beautifully. And that's when I wonder, when am I going to hear Allison Larkin's first album? how much of April is you with the guitar?
I did play a little guitar when I was younger, and I took up guitar again to be able to write April better. But that first scene where she goes to an open mic, I did not steal a car to go, but I did go to an open mic with a song I had written when I was in my 20s and just kind of didn't tell anyone I was going and showed up and had no idea what I was supposed to do or what was going to happen. And I had pretty terrible stage fright, but just had this moment of kind of, you know, where you kind of like, you blank out, like you leave your body and get through this thing and people are applauding and you're like, what just happened? You know, I sort of had that moment and gave it to April, but most of the book is not, you know, doesn't match up with my life as exactly as that. But, yeah, I mean, I did, you know, I was a theater major when I was at Ithaca and I did study voice. And so music has been a big part of my life. And, you know, I wanted April to have, well, April showed up having that already, but it was something I was really interested in exploring, and exploring music in, you know, exactly what you were talking about. Anytime you show your art in, you know, whatever art it is, what it means to kind of make your living as an artist in the world, what it feels like to bare your soul to people. You know, I wanted to play with that quite a bit.
We get a lot of good 90s music. We get some good cover song references. We get some original lyrics from April throughout this book. And we get a lot of 90s pop culture. So kids of the 90s like me, yeah, this this book is it's a nice little nod to 90s culture before the world of cell phones. I mean, for your younger readers, they're going to struggle with the idea of payphones, but those were a thing. But April goes out and she crushes it in her open mic, and it's electrifying to her. And as we mentioned in the introduction here, her father, you know, destroys her guitar. It's basically one of the most abusive things that he could do, whether he knows it or not. He might think he's teaching her a lesson, but her relationship with her father is already so broken, and she's hanging on by the edges to her life. And then he takes that away from her, and she decides she's got to get out of there. She's only 16 years old, and she goes, well, why don't you just describe a little bit about where she goes and a little bit of the pickle she gets herself into, Allison?
Well, she ends up just getting in Irene's car and driving, and she doesn't know where she's going to go. But she, of course, has this fear of, like, is anybody coming after her, because she just stole a car again, and ends up in Ithaca staying in a campground. And then, you know, in trying to just make her way, gets a job and starts to set up her life in Ithaca. But she does that saying that she's older than she is, and that creates an extra problem for her as well.
Yeah, I have. So I have a fan. I got to be careful with how. I have a family member that I know, who once told me that when we met his new girlfriend, we had to say that he was turning 38 years old the next week. Well, he was turning 40. And I said to him, what is the difference here? 2 years? Like, why are you doing? Why would you lie about your age in a new relationship? And he said, the difference is, if I were 37 turning 38, I still have a 3 in front in the first digit there, as opposed to a 4. And I said, so play this out for me. The relationship goes well, and then 2 years from now, your girlfriend, I don't know, maybe your fiance wants to throw you a surprise 40th birthday party, and everyone who knows you has to explain to her that you're actually 42 and that you've been lying. How is that going to go? But you know what? Sometimes we lie in the moment to protect ourselves or because we think it's the right thing to do just to sort of make a situation easier. And April's situation is very, very different than the person I just described. She's not 39 turning 40. She's 16 and wants to be viewed as an adult in a world that she's just run to. So for her 19, not 16, she can pass for 19. The problem is she meets a pretty good guy who doesn't know she's 16. And I like the struggle that you write about there, Allie, because April is a character who is fundamentally a good person, I think is fair to say, but she gets in her own way a lot, and she knows that if she gets in a relationship with this guy who's 27, Adam's 27, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, 27, that he would not get into a relationship with a 16-year-old, but he might take a shot at a relationship with a 19-year-old. She feels that that is a horrible betrayal to him because he's been through a lot. But at the same time, all she wants to do is reinvent her life and start from scratch. And she just sort of convinces herself, if I just start over, if I just say, this is it, this is where my new life starts, everything behind is past and it's over and we're hitting the reset button, then maybe I can do this. And I think that push-pull she had, even if the average reader can't relate to doing exactly that, we've all had something in our life where we think, I really should come clean about this, but is it going to hurt the person I'm coming clean to? Should I just go with this lie? Should I not tell them? And then it gets bigger than you can control. And it becomes this monster that you know eventually is going to sort of come out of the closet, so to speak. And I think your writing about that relationship is really beautiful because we're all rooting for April, but we know she's got to do the right thing. Was it hard to sort of write those relationships because you had that personal relationship with this character and you know she's going to fall on her face a bit?
Yeah. I mean, the other part of it too is that writing this character for such a long time, I got older while it was writing it. And so the older I got, the more I was aware of the intense sadness of a 16-year-old girl who had so much need and how that translates into what you think you want when you need something. So I was playing with that a lot. That was something that really kind of weighed heavily on me in terms of figuring out, like, almost figuring out, almost as if I was a reader, like figuring out what you're rooting for, you know, and figuring out in such a complex situation what is the happiest version of the story? What is, what is the actual ideal outcome? Even, you know, some of the things that we think we want when we're 16 or 17 or 18, or, you know, as we get older, we realize that maybe the best of what we could have in a moment wasn't really the best thing for us either. So it was an interesting situation to kind of have a story that I had set up and then look at it from different angles as I got older and my perspective changed too.
That is so interesting to me. There's also, I think there's something, nostalgic is the wrong word, but there's something very much evocative of a pre-cell phone culture. I don't know who to credit with the Seinfeld theory, Megan Mack. Do you? Who is that? A Tom Tucker theory? We have a friend named Tom, who a friend of the program, who has a theory about the '90s show Seinfeld that roughly half the plots would not work today because of cell phones. Remember when they get lost in the parking garage? Where did they park? Well, they would have just taken a picture with their cell phone camera. They would have called each other. They couldn't find each other. They're driving the Bubble Boy episode. They're driving on the highway. They get the two cars can't find each other. They lose each other. They don't know what exit they've got off of. They have no cell phone to call each other. So the Seinfeld theory is that half of the Seinfeld plots would be detonated by modern cell phones. The April plot would be certainly influenced by this fact that it's hard to ghost people this completely anymore. But April runs from her problem. She starts running. She runs. She leaves her dad and Irene, and then she goes to Ithaca and she builds a life there. Things eventually
blow. Don't give us spoilers.
I got to be careful. But she finds it necessary to run instead of confront the pain that she's afraid will either be done to her or others, and she's able to. Well, I mean, she builds a life in which she kind of goes through a cycle of starting new, building up, finding some hope, but feeling like she's either not deserving of it or she can't keep lies together. And as a reader, you start wondering, like, how are, you got to break this. Like, you can't live like this forever. But is it partially that this is a character in your mind who ultimately didn't feel that she was deserving of the good life that she starts to build in various places like Ithaca?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think when you grow up not feeling valued, it's very hard to believe that, somebody else is going to value you when you have a misstep, when you do something wrong, when you it's hard to have the faith that you can step up and be good enough for somebody else. And I think that, a lot of people, I think in psychology, they call it like pulling a location. A lot of times people do actually just pick up and leave someplace because it's easier to think about that. I think now everything comes with us wherever we go. And back then it didn't, which also made things a lot more dramatic when you said goodbye to somebody in 1996, you were really saying goodbye to them. You didn't know if you'd ever see them again, you know. You weren't going to run into them on the internet. We didn't know that we'd find people again, you know. Like, I've now found people from the 90s on Instagram and Facebook. And
probably some you didn't even want to find.
yeah, exactly. Sometimes you find people and you're like, oh, I missed you. And then sometimes some people maybe should have been a memory. But I think that, dealing with the finality of her decisions was important. And yeah, not having MapQuest even, not having reliable ways to keep in touch with people, was definitely part of the storytelling, but also, you know, I'm a 90s kid. I wanted to honor that.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. I frankly find that, I find it really compelling. I mean, maybe it's because I'm a 90s kid too, and I'm biased in that way, but I love that part of the storytelling. I love the idea of leaving a letter, not a text message, but writing a letter or leaving actual words that you've written down for people and the finality and the weight that can come with them as opposed to, you know, just a very short series of texts. I mean, it's just a very different world that we're in, and it's only been 25 years, and the world's changed that much since then. Talking to Allison Larkin, the author of the book, The People We Keep, the new book out now. It is a new book to us. It is not a new book to Allie. She is an accomplished author. Literally, her first book, Stay, an international bestseller. I mean, I remember hearing that it's selling great numbers in Italy, and I'm going, you are an actual international bestseller, Rochesterian Allison Larkin. I think it's a great and beautiful thing. But finally, the world gets to meet this character that she's been creating for many, many years. And I wondered, do you have? You know, I know you know other novelists, and you can sort of kind of keep company sometimes and bounce ideas off other writers. Do many writers have that book in them where they go, okay, here's my series of novels, but deep down, this is what I want. This is the story I want to tell. And someday I'll get an agent or a publisher who lets me do this, even if it breaks the form that they're used to.
I do think that a lot of novelists have this secret novel that they're working on. I don't know that everybody does. And you know, some people find the person who's going to represent their entire career and is super happy with everything they write. But that's a really hard thing to find, because I think that, you know, if we look at the things that we like, we can all like the same book or the same TV show or the same movie or the same music, but we might be taking something different from it. And so, you know, of the people I worked with prior to this liked aspects of my work, and that didn't mean that they were ready for April, or knew what to do with her. And so, I think a lot of novelists have that. We, you know, we have these like Venn diagrams where we meet up with the people we work with, and it isn't always two perfect circles overlapping perfectly.
And so I want to talk about poverty. I mean, April is someone who's essentially homeless, relying on a number of ways to get by, places to stay. I think there are some scenes that really draw poverty really, really well. And again, without giving too much away, there's an example that comes to mind is she's kind of on a road trip with a guy, and he buys a Zagnut candy bar because he thinks it's a funny name. He thinks like, who would eat this? And it's more of a joke. And he wants her to laugh, but she can't relate to the notion of just buying something as a joke because it costs money, even a candy bar. She can't relate to checking into a hotel and not even finding out how much it costs, not going through a bill and knowing, can I afford this? Because she's figured out a way to get by, sometimes by creating a network of places that she would be safe to stay at on the road and could still find a way to afford or get to. It's a very, very different life than some of the people that she encounters. But when you're writing about poverty in this way, about someone who's literally hungry a lot and is open about, you know, just not having a place to shower and feeling a certain way about themselves for those reasons, how much work did you do to make sure you really understood what that mentality is like? Because that is the reality for millions of people.
Yeah. You know, I don't want to pretend that that's something that I went through directly, because I didn't. I've always had certain safety nets in place, but I did. When I dropped out of college, I worked in restaurants and bars, and I worked at a biker bar for a little while, and I was trying very hard to not need anything from anybody. And I had dropped out of college, so my friends were still in college, you know, having like dining hall food and not really dealing with the day-to-day life. And I felt very removed from their existence because I was very much, you know, sometimes going to work hoping to make enough in tips to get to the gas station before it closed on the way home, to be able to make it back home. And that wasn't, you know, it wasn't a terminal situation for me. I ended up going back to college. I had a lot of advantages and opportunities. So I'm not pretending to know what it's like to live like that on a continual basis. But that perspective of being so different from my peers and feeling so removed and having that struggle and thinking about it, you know, like the constant math you're doing in your head, the constant strategizing, how it takes over your thought processes and your life. And, you know, when you're trying to skip a meal or stretch a meal out, and, you know, or your home situation doesn't feel safe, things like that. It definitely contributed to an awareness that I think I've brought with me through my whole life to understanding what that feels like on a level that I wouldn't have if I hadn't had that experience.
Yeah. And I think the conversation in publishing is generally a healthy one and sometimes a precarious one, or kind of generally, I think it's healthy to ask what experiences should be within the purview of certain writers to write about. I think there are times where we lose the plot a little bit with that conversation. I mean, ultimately, we still have fiction. We are drawing imagined characters and scenarios and scenes. But I think it's healthy to ask, you know, who can credibly write about certain people from certain backgrounds or certain life experiences. I find your writing on April and her life eminently credible, believable, powerful. But I think when you started writing about April, there were fewer of those conversations in publishing than there are now. What do you make of those conversations about, you know, well, you shouldn't write about XYZ unless you are XYZ or have lived XYZ. What do you think about that?
I mean, that's a super loaded conversation. And I don't necessarily even know that I'm qualified to talk about it, except that I think the biggest issue in that is that we have not been giving voice to diverse people in people with diversity of experience on the level that we should as a whole, not just in publishing, everywhere. And so I think that it's really important to think about who, you know, what stories we're allowing to be told from a perspective of people who are entitled to tell their stories. You know, I think a concern I have about that is that sometimes in fiction, we want to write about things that we don't necessarily want to talk about personally. Even in relation to this book, there's some things in the book that I don't necessarily want to talk about, from my own personal life that definitely influenced the book. And so that, I think that's a concern because, you know, who's to say who's had what experience, but sometimes it's a little bit more obvious. But I think the really most important part of all of it is that we are looking at, we're looking at the merit of a story and the storyteller without looking at, at one point someone had told me that I didn't have the pedigree to write this book because it seemed kind of more literary. And I went to Jersey Shore bartending school. I do have a bachelor's degree, but like, I didn't go to Iowa. I didn't go, you know, to a big, I don't have an MFA. I don't have a PhD. I think we really have to look at how we're relating to authors in terms of who's allowed to tell stories because, somebody who everybody has a right to tell their story and everybody's story is valid to them. And I think we have to look at where we're giving merit and where we aren't. Is somebody getting ignored because they don't have a PhD? You know, I have certain advantages to myself, but lots of people don't even have that. And how are we finding art and how are we supporting it? I think that's a really important question.
Boy,
and whose stories are we not hearing because the process is killing their spirit? I'm really concerned about that because artists a lot of times have to be porous people and I think we need to be more careful with them and more supportive.
Yeah, the notion that you don't have the pedigree to write this story is wild to me. But let's talk a little bit about your experience in the industry because I think this will be instructive for aspiring writers. You have had some very, very good experiences with agents and people in the industry who care about your work and will invest in it. And then you've had people who have very limited views on what they would like you to do and what could sell, et cetera, et cetera. How do you feel in general about the state of the publishing industry right now?
I mean, I am so blessed with the people I'm working with right now. I'm so thankful. I found my people and they're amazing. And I am so happy for that. And I think sometimes it just takes time to find your people. I really, in the past couple of years, have started subscribing to the theory that everyone's just doing the best that they can. And I think what that means is that, you know, some people just aren't your people. Like they're not going to understand you. Their best is different from what you're looking for. And that's kind of a no fault situation. But I think that, you know, finding the people who truly understand us take a lot of time. It just does. And so I'm grateful that I found that. And for me personally, the state of the publishing industry is great. I have such an amazing team and it's been so lovely to work with them because every time this book has a win, it feels like it's a win for all of us. And I've just been so supported now. and I'm really happy with that. But I know publishing in general has a long way to go in a lot of ways too. But I do think that there's some movement towards trying to be more inclusive, and I hope we get there.
Well, and what advice would you give to a writer who feels like maybe it's hard enough to get an agent, by the way, but let's say you've got somebody. I'm thrilled that you have a team that feels right to you, because that is such a gift and it's so valuable to have that. I mean, we all need that in our lives around us. But for writers, that can be hard to find, whether it's publisher, agent, et cetera. And if you're an aspiring writer, on the one hand, you want somebody who's tough, someone who will be critical and constructive and has a good eye for what you're doing and will understand what's going to work out in the world. But at the same time, you don't want someone who's so limited or maybe doesn't understand what's in your heart and what you're trying to do. And if you've got, I mean, how do you discern what's what, I guess, is what I'm asking. What advice would you give to other writers?
I mean, I think some of it does just take time and trial and error. It's such a hard system in finding an agent, because you're trying to be chosen, but you also have to choose somebody. And, mm-hmm. I mean, I think I got rejected for about a year before I found my first agent, and she was lovely. And that was a great situation for that moment. And then the book that I wanted to write was, April, was so different from the book that I'd been working on. So I had to move on. But I think that we, it's important to go into it with a sense of understanding of your own work and what you want to do to the best of your ability at the time. I've found that the best writing advice I get is usually from other writers. So cultivating those relationships and knowing what you want your work to be, so that you can have conversations with an agent that are about how to make your vision the clearest and best that it can be, instead of going with like a half-formed work and saying, how do I do this? I think it's really important. I think that, we have to kind of build up our faith in ourselves to go out into the world and work with other people. And I don't know that I understood that when I started in the same way that I do now. And I did spend some time trying to make this story what other people wanted it to be. And, that made it a very long journey, because I tried to, there was a rom-com version of this book that was absolutely terrible.
A rom-com version.
Yeah, there was definitely a romantic comedy version of this book with a very romantic comedy ending, and it didn't work, but it was, somebody's attempt at making my book fit with my other work. What actually saved things for me was that I'd gotten obsessed with this Chris Parikh song called Compass Rose. Chris Parikh is my favorite musician. And it's the lyrics that are at the beginning of the book talking about, I know someday I'll offer up a song I was made to play. And I got obsessed with that song and those lyrics, and I realized that this was a book I was made to write, that everything I'd gone through in my life, everything I'd experienced kind of spun itself into an allegory. And this is the book I was made to write. And if that's the importance of it, then I couldn't compromise on it. And that kind of gave me the backbone to keep going and say no and move on and find the people that I needed, which is interesting because it also somewhat parallels the book in general.
Talking to Allison Larkin, the author of the new novel, The People We Keep. Her other books are Stay, Why Can't I Be You?, Swimming for Sunlight. If you want to see something truly absurd, go to Amazon and see what the reviews of her books look like, which it's hard not to read what people are saying, but boy, people really like your work, so that's nice. I mean, not every critic's going to love everything, and not every reader's going to love everything, but there has to be some gratification for you, because, my God, this is the story that you wanted to tell more than others. You had people in the industry who wanted you to keep writing, and again, there's nothing wrong with the genre that your first novel, Stay, was in. But they wanted to turn this book into a rom-com, and now it's out in the world, and people really like it. Critics really like it. Readers are responding to it. Is there an I told you so in you about this at all?
It's not really an I told you so, because I really don't fault people for trying to, you know, the industry, the publishing industry is an industry. So I don't really fault people for trying to problem solve. Like, it meant that they liked my work enough that they were trying to figure out how they could set it in their minds in a way that it could sell and fit and work. But, you know, what ended up happening was that I got to a point where I was so frustrated, I guess, that I decided I was just going to write this book for me. And I took out any advice that I'd ever taken that didn't quite feel right. And I put, you know, I went back, you know, 10 years of drafts to pick up an old sentence. So this book is exactly what I needed it to be. And I found people who allowed me to do that, to have that authority on the book. But I wrote it for me. There was a point where I thought, maybe I'll never even share this book. I'm just going to finish it and make it feel right.
Yeah.
Because that's what I need to do as a human being. So to have other people connect with this book really just makes the world feel like a place with a lot more kindred spirits than I thought there were. You know, if this is the book that I needed to write and some other people feel like it's the book that they needed to read, I'm going to get a little choked up talking about that. Like, that's a beautiful thing. And I'm so grateful for that. And I think that gratefulness and, you know, that kind of goosebump feeling of knowing that other people feel the same inside as I do, that there's love out there for April in the world, that drowns out any kind of like I told you so feeling. But it is validating as a writer and a human, and I'm so grateful for it.
In our remaining time, I want to talk about some of the themes that I think are really important here. April has a habit of assuming she cannot be forgiven. April has this habit of thinking, well, now I am in too deep, and the people that I've come to love and care about will not accept me if I own up to everything about me that maybe they don't know. And the easier thing to do is run. How universal do you think that is? I mean, April's story is certainly her own, but that is so many of us, isn't it? Thinking that, why try to repair this? This is going to sound ridiculous, but that goes all the way down to the micro level. And I mean, let's say you get a text from a friend you haven't heard from in a while, and you're driving, and you think, I can't respond now, but I'm so glad to hear from this person. I'm going to think of the perfect response. But then that night you're busy, you go to bed, you haven't texted back. The next day you think, I'm going to send the perfect response, but I want to have some time here. Then you don't write back. Well, now it's been 2 days, and now you cannot text the person back. What you have to do is just pray that they can exist and be happy and love you, and you can never you'll never talk to them again. That's the end of that, because you didn't text back in time, and you're a bad person, and they will not accept that it took this long, and it's best just to wait until our inevitable death, as opposed to confront the fact that we should have texted back sooner. I mean, we all do stuff like this. It's amazing.
Yes, we do.
I mean, to the micro, to the macro, to the big, painful lies that we've told that we wish we knew and never did. I find that very relatable, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And that's why I suspect a lot of your readers are connecting. What are you hearing?
I think that exact scenario, I understand. I always like take longer on the things that like the email I most want to respond to is the one I never write because I'm trying to make it perfect in my head, you know, or I want to give myself time to think. I think that is really relatable. I think that, you know, a little bit we get set up as kids with this idea of like, if we don't do our homework or we don't, you know, we have a misstep that we're bad or we're wrong. And I've seen a lot of like child psychology now talking about how like kids do the best that they can very earnestly. And if they're struggling, it's because there's a real struggle there. And I don't think that, you know, we grew up in a culture that gave us that, you know, someone, you know, your age, like our age, and so I think we all walk around with a lot of shame, but I think that, you know, I really do I mean, I've listened to a lot of Brene Brown to get there, but I really do think we are all doing the best we can with what we have to work with. And sometimes that's not going to be good enough for other people. But sometimes if we give ourselves grace, we realize that there's grace there for us from other people as well. And that we, you know, that's a reinforcing loop, you know, like saying, hey, I didn't text you because I went through this whole process in my head means that someone else will feel better when they forget to text you because they went through that whole process and that makes them more comfortable with you, you know?
Yeah. Are you a forgiving person by nature?
I am. I think sometimes I have to set boundaries for myself that I don't naturally have because I can hurt myself by not having good boundaries there and forgiving things that maybe shouldn't be forgiven. But, you know, I'm kind of a no-fault person on a lot of stuff, especially now where you just realize that, like, it's so hard to be human. It is so hard to be a human being. And I think we've really come to face that in the pandemic that, you know, wherever we are, it's just getting through your day is a challenge. And we can have good intentions and not necessarily come through the way we wish we did. And maybe we can just realize that everybody's kind of trying to hold themselves together. And when we meet up well, that's a beautiful miracle.
Well said. And the book also draws a portrait of chosen family, not blood family, but chosen family. And what it can mean to really view and value and find family as you go throughout life, not necessarily blood related. That's a big theme for you, isn't it?
It is. I think that is like my theme. And when I've talked about all my books, kind of having the same heart, I think you'll always find that element of found family. Even when that found family includes a dog, but even when it doesn't, I am so lucky to have these people in my life who, you know, I don't share genes with, but I share so much love with and so much history. I'm so grateful for that. I have the most amazing friends. And I've learned so much. And I've also benefited from having so many great multi-generational relationships in my life too. And I think that's been an important part, and you'll see that in my work quite a bit.
Yeah, and dovetailing those two themes together, forgiveness and also chosen or found family. April in this book has to make a decision on whether she does want to get back home for a very, very important family event that I won't give too much away about. But she wrestles with whether to even go. And how far gone a relationship is. I do think there is, everybody's got a different line for this, Allie, but I do think there is something relatable as well to saying, when do we forgive? When is someone worthy of forgiveness? And I think being worthy of forgiveness means owning the pain that you've caused. And that's where I do appreciate about April is she knows she's caused pain. She's not going to deny that.
Yeah.
She's scared that no one would ever forgive her for it, but she knows it. Whereas, you know, I'm not sure some in her family understand how much pain they've caused. So you got to be worthy of forgiveness. And I think there are times where people decide this relationship is, we may be related by blood, but it is not worth the emotional pain that it causes me anymore. And I have to break it. I have to break away from it. I have to leave it behind. That is such a hard choice. But there are people in our lives who they would never be in our lives if they weren't blood family. And I think April reflects some of the pain that a lot of people have in making those hard calls.
Yeah. Somebody told me once that you can't and shouldn't forgive someone who's still hurting you.
Mm-hmm.
You can't forgive what's still happening while it's happening. And I think that, you know, that's a part of it. And I think even then, it's like you can find forgiveness in your heart if you put a boundary in place. And I also think that, you know, the beautiful thing about found family is that, like, when you're choosing people, you know, everything we do in our lives is in place of something else. Every time we spend time with one person, it's in place of spending time with somebody else or with ourselves or, you know, with our dogs or in peace. And so I think, you know, choosing a family is choosing how we spend our time, and time is limited. So I think sometimes that makes choices for us too, is where we have the energy and the effort. And we can sometimes love people and realize that love needs to stay a more distant thing to protect everybody involved. You know,
you could have written such a pat ending here. You set a scene that opened up the possibility of a perfectly pat ending, and instead, without giving too much away, you gave April a glimpse into the pain that she sometimes has caused, and she doesn't deny it. She hears it, and but you also give us. I think there's a lot of hope and beauty in the way you do choose to end this book. Again, being as vague as I can, but in our last minute, what do you hope people take from this book?
I think the thing about April causing other people pain and realizing that she's caused other people pain is realizing that people have cared about her in a way that she didn't think that they did. And so, you know, I kind of think that when we're all caught up in our own shame about our own failings and things like that, I think maybe just realizing that other people do care about us, that, you know, we're feeling shame about a text message we didn't send, but maybe other people aren't keeping score like that because they just love us. You know, that I think that, you know, we're so connected in ways that we don't even realize we are. And we have such a lasting effect on the people we've been kind to, and the people who have been kind to us stay with us for such a long time. And I would love if people read this book and take stock of their life in that way and think about the people who have mattered.
Allison Larkin's new book is The People We Keep. And I hope listeners have a chance now to understand why it's gotten critical acclaim. I admire Allie for not calling it the I Told You So book, but this is a book that was in her for a long time. And we claim, Rochesterians claim Allie as one of our own because she wrote from here and published some of her first books from here. So we'll always claim you. This is one of your found homes. Sorry about that, Allie.
It is. No, I am thankful I miss Rochester.
Congratulations on this truly beautiful book.
Thank you so much, Evan.
You'll find it wherever books are sold, but especially your small independent bookstores. It's The People We Keep, and that's Allison Larkin. From the whole team at Connections, Rob Braden, Emery Stein, Evan Dawson, Megan Mack saying thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.